of having that tie surgically released. And then after surgery, helping you with getting baby to relearn latching, sucking in a more functional way. Okay, so those are my top tips for, you know, preparing prenatally. Now, thinking about phrenectomy, just want to briefly touch on it, and I'm sure other providers here are going to go more in depth, but breastfeeding can absolutely help with breastfeeding. It can make a world of difference for so many families. However, there are also limitations with phrenectomy, and timing matters. So how can, you know, on the upside, how can it help? There are definitely mechanical advantages for having full passive range of motion of one's tongue, lips, and cheeks when it comes to breastfeeding. Now I say passive because after phrenectomy, I can go in and I can elevate your baby's tongue much, much more, but some of these babies can't. They, you know, pre-phrenectomy, they were elevating like 10% or so. After phrenectomy, I can elevate 80%, 90%. They're still elevating only 10%. Some of these babies that have a lot of weakness and are a little uncoordinated. So passive range of motion is what from phrenectomy. And there is a potential there for passive improved lip flanging, improved gape opening. I'm gonna try to use my hands, but the degree of mouth opening when we're thinking about upper lip tie, upper cheek ties, things like that, impacts how wide baby can open their mouth, which matters a lot for breastfeeding. There's also the potential for improved anterior seal with the lips and tongue on mom's breast, which is really critical. And just thinking about straw drinking, in order to generate suction, negative pressure, you have to have a nice seal, 360 degrees all the way around. We don't want babies curling their lips in and sucking in a lot of air in the corners of their mouth. We're gonna get gassiness, hiccups, fussiness, all of that. Aerophagia is what it's called, air eating. Okay, so then we also have the potential for, yeah, improved tongue elevation, peristaltic tongue movement, this wave-like motion that really helps remove milk from mom's breast. So, okay, so those are the, you know, positives, right? There are also with breastfeeding. Now, something a lot of families don't know, which I really harp on with my patients, is that in addition to what it can do for breastfeeding and bottle feeding, as mentioned earlier, there are many, many benefits and implications for orofacial development, feeding skills with solid food, speech, posture, airway, sleep, and so, so much more. And sometimes when we start to go through it, parents go, wait a second, I'm experiencing some of those issues. Maybe I have a tie, you know, and so it starts to help them realize the long-term implications of doing this as well. In addition to helping breastfeeding today, what it can do for tomorrow, potentially. Now, limitations of phrenectomy. We're increasing passive range of motion of tongue, lips, cheeks via phrenectomy. However, the motor plan for breastfeeding does not automatically change. We wish it did, but babies have been practicing sucking since they were in mom's uterus. From end of first trimester, they're sucking. You can see them on ultrasound sucking their fists and their fingers, and they're swallowing all day long, every single day, starting earlier, but very consistently at 26 weeks of pregnancy and beyond. So we have to teach them how to use a better motor pattern. Typically tied babies, they use a compression dominant latch. It can be painful, or if they're really weak, it's not painful. And they just kind of fall off the breast. They just don't get suction seal to stay on. So as a board certified lactation consultant and also pulling in my occupational therapy, feeding therapy background too, I'm working with families on how to reduce this compensation and create a new motor plan. We're working on it before phrenectomy too, but really after phrenectomy is when babies are able to do a much, much better job. So let's see. So thinking my example here is think about, you know, squeezing toothpaste out of a tube. That's what a lot of these babies with ties do versus sucking the toothpaste out of the tube. So positive pressure doesn't work very well. Negative pressure is what we need with breastfeeding. And then the other limitation of phrenectomy is that it's really limited based on the skill of the provider. It's dependent on the skill of the provider. So where did they train? Who did they train with? What kind of outcomes are they getting surgically? Parents don't know. They just see phrenectomy and go and run in, you know, get the release done, then ask questions later. And I get patients who were working on release number three, number four. It's really, really tough when it was incomplete or veered too far right, veered too far left, too deep. I mean, it can be very interesting sometimes what can happen with when the provider doesn't when their skill level isn't really compatible with what that baby was needing. And then of course there's wound care, and there's a lot of debate about wound care, but I find with my patients having the wound care done consistently with the appropriate frequency, not too much, not too little, not too much force, not too aggressively, not too little force is really, really important. And not only that, but when is the wound care done? Some babies, if you do it right before feedings, they fall apart and they don't want to latch. So we have to really individualize and customize when we're doing the wound care for the family and the baby in front of us, which is something that an IBCLC who has this experience would be able to do. So frenectomy does not address the mom piece of the puzzle. And that's really important for a lot of dentists listening, or ENTs or pediatricians, whoever is doing these releases, because mom is a huge piece with breastfeeding, a huge part of breastfeeding. And if she has prior surgery, prior breast surgery, implants, reductions, if she has hormone imbalance, inverted nipples, flat nipples, insufficient glandular tissue, if there are factors going on with mom too that aren't being addressed, then the frenectomy might get blamed as it didn't work, but maybe there was something going on with mom that needed to be addressed and wasn't addressed. So that matters a lot. Also thinking about the baby is not stimulating mom's breast really well, we need to preserve her milk supply with pumping in the short term. So that's where the IBCLC comes in. And then why does timing matter? Timing matters because a frenectomy done for the right reasons, but at the wrong time, can lead to either no change of breastfeeding, even worse breastfeeding skills, or full-blown refusal to nurse. And I've seen all this happen in my practice. I have a case right now where right after frenectomy, baby was hospitalized because of feeding refusal. It went on for about 10, 12 hours, and the parents really freaked out and had to, you know, understandably, and had to go to hospital. And this happens a lot, unfortunately. It's not something that's spoken about, but I tell release providers, you don't want your name to be spoken in that room with the screaming baby who won't eat. When they're asking at the ER, why is your baby not eating? What's different about today? When they say, well, we had a frenectomy with blank, you know, so we want to make sure baby's in a good position for a frenectomy, so we don't make things worse. And then last bit I wanted to speak about was, of course, you know, for families who are wanting to give their baby human milk, but either do not make enough milk or don't make any milk, you know, for one reason or another, there's formal milk banks. In different states, there are different policies about, you know, if there's milk available for the public or not. It's going to cost roughly $3 to $6 an ounce, so it's extremely expensive. It's not a viable option for every family, because most of these milk banks, they are providing the milk first and foremost to babies in the NICU, because it's life saving for those babies. And then there's informal milk sharing, which really seems to be on the rise. I'm in a lot of the groups. I like to, you know, read what's going on, and moms are going above and beyond to try and get milk to one another, especially thinking about babies with food allergies who needed a very specific formula. And now that formula is not on the shelf, those moms are extremely grateful if they can find another mother who happens to be dairy-free and egg-free or whatever, or, you know, whatever the baby needs, and is able to then provide them with that specific milk. Now with informal milk sharing, milk can be pasteurized at home. However, it does rely on the trust between that donor and the recipient of the milk, because there is no formal screening process. There is a risk of contamination, risk of bacterial and viral transmission. So there are risks that do need to be taken seriously, but this is something a lot of people are doing with their own sister or their friend or other trusted individuals in their community. So that's my piece for now. And I'm happy to chime in more later if needed.
Thank you. And for an frenectomy piece, Dr. Kotlow, this I think would be a really good space for you to jump into to address a couple of the things that Marissa talked about. And then we can from.
Well, we have a short amount of time. I don't agree with everything that you just said, Marissa, completely. I think that the frenectomy affects the mother as much as the baby. I have mothers coming in all the time crying because they haven't been able to latch a bond to their baby. And as the dental surgeon, I wear many hats. And we get these mothers coming in here in postpartum depression because they haven't bonded. And we release these tongue ties. And before they leave the office, you know, I've got 48 years of doing this and lasers for the last 25 years. So I think that it's real important when you do a frenectomy, do consider the mother and what's going on with her, both emotionally and physically. And you're right, with the nipple shield inverted. And they have seen 4 or 5 lactation people. If you look behind me, you'll notice something. That's an instrument which I've just developed. It's called the tongue guide. There's three different instruments, two are for surgery and one is for home care. So we've improved our home care because the parents don't have to put their fingers into the mouth. If I'm not going to give an advertisement, but if you want to learn about it, go to my website, kidsteethwith2ds.com, and go to breastfeeding. There's videos on how to use it and the procedures and all that stuff. I think to answer all of your questions, anyone interested, I'm giving a 7-hour course on Friday. You can go to my website again and take the course if you want. I think that aftercare is all over the board. People have all different opinions, but I think it's a matter of how often is not as important as how well it's done. I think that when you're dealing with practitioners, you've got to watch a lot because there are some laser companies selling lasers to do frenectomies. I mean, I had one doctor call me up one day and say, I just bought a practice. I've got a laser in here. I want to start doing babies. What should I do? I said, leave it in the box until you're trained. You know, nobody does a root canal the first second they get into dental school. If they do, they won't do anymore. You don't do implants without training. You don't do cone beam without training. So training is a real interesting word. Someone hears me lecture for 3 hours, they go back and tell people life training. Hands-on is difficult because when people come to my office, if I said, I have somebody new in my office who's going to learn, I said, we're here for you. So hands-on is difficulty, and you don't start with a baby. It's just like you don't start on a root canal with an upper second molar with 5 roots. You know, you want to do an anterior tooth, something simple. So you start with teenagers. I think that the skill maybe ASAP, because all the work in the world isn't going to do anything. That tongue has zero function. If you have what use my classification 1, 2, 3, and 4, where 1 is at the base and 4 is at the tip, you know, when you have a 3 or a 4, a lactation consultant is the second person who's going to see that baby. The first one's going to be the nurse in the delivery room, and you know, That's where it all begins, right there. Proper evaluation. The lactation people in the hospital don't have their lips sealed because they're told by their pediatricians they don't believe in what's going on. And they get them to an outside lactation consultant who can do what she wants. So, and a chiropractor, body worker. Anyway, Larry, I could go on and on, but
Larry?
Go. Yes.
So we want our audience to hear all points of view, which is great.
Okay.
So why don't we, Pat? We want to bring Kevin on now.
Yes, absolutely. Ready for Kevin to come on now.
Let's go through everybody's point of view, and then we can go back and open it up, and we can have a real great discussion, and people can ask their questions.
Can I share a screen, or
you want me to show your slides?
No, yeah. I want to show my slides. Okay. I don't want you.
I will do that. Wait a minute. I will give you permission to do that. But you can start talking.
Well, okay. You know how I am when I start talking. I don't stop.
Okay. No, go ahead.
Kevin, just keep going down your lane.
Go ahead, Kevin. Kevin, share your screen.
I take after Papa Hinden. Okay, here we go. Share. Can you...
You said play.
Yeah, I got that. Can you see that?
Perfect.
Part of it?
Yes.
Oh,
that's perfect.
Okay, here we go. Well, I was planning on introducing, Dr. Townsend and Dr. Kotlow, but you've already done a beautiful job. So I am going to talk about breastfeeding and dental malocclusion very quickly. Most of you have heard all this. And then I was going to bring on the others. Dr. Townsend, we're in for a real treat. And Dr. Kotlow, which you just heard. He is always a treat. So anyway, This is what Dr. Townsend, my new friend, is going to talk about. We all know that, you know, human milk is superior than other mammals' milk, especially cows. Well, how come? And this guy's figured it out along with other people, but has a way of translating it. And so you got a real treat coming there. I liken to what has happened with breast milk, cow's milk, is like what's happened with grains and how they, you know, take away the fiber and take away the germ. Well, that takes away all the vitamins. Well, when cow's milk, it's more than vitamins. These oligosaccharides are very powerful nutrients, if you will, that they try to put them back. Well, some of them might come back, but there's over 200 in breast milk, and he's really going to cover that. So look how many cow's milk has, how almost none, and look at the percentage that in human milk. So me, I'm going to cover the mechanical advantages of getting milk from a breast, working for it the way all mammals are intended to do from the beginning of the mammalian part of the animal kingdom, which goes back millions of years before the dinosaurs, actually. And it just, you cannot get that. Human milk from a cup is certainly better than from a bottle, but getting it from the breast is ideal when women can do it. Men really shouldn't talk about breastfeeding because we can't do it. I can talk about scientific aspects of it. That's why I'm so grateful for Marissa and Pat. And then we're going to have a dad, you know, talk about his experience. This is on the left is what occurred for literally millions of pre-human before we became anatomically modern human 300,000 years ago. Most people don't know that. This should be taught in kindergarten like it is in France. In America, this isn't part of the medical or dental curriculum. We don't learn about anthropology, but this is how humans, when agriculture happened 10,000 years ago, women still were able to breastfeed. They would work at their looms and the men would be out, you know, he's got his rifle up there, but he would hunt and then watch his wife work. But she could breastfeed this kid till he was four. And that's what humans did. Cottage industry came along before, you know, steam powered looms happened and women entered the workforce. And they could breastfeed. There it is. So it didn't stop. And then industry happened. And who are the first skilled laborers in the Industrial Revolution but women? And they had to abandon what? Breastfeeding on demand. Hiring wet nurses, you know, women that were lactating in the village, they could breastfeed while they were at work in the steel mills or climbing in the coal mines. Look at that. All right. So that's what occurred. That is called, this is called ontogeny, what happens in one generation. And this is a graph from an invited editorial that I wrote about 10 years ago that really discusses how breastfeeding, the longer a kid is breastfed, the less likely they are to have severe malocclusion. It's not a prospective randomized trial. It's observational, but powerful nonetheless. We are thinking that retrognathic mandibles, backwards chins, chinless, starts in utero. We haven't proved that. It's a hypothesis that it is testable. This is a child of a mom who was a hygienist who brought her child to me and said, she had five kids in my chair. And she said, am I making you another baby? And she showed me this. And sure enough, I started treating him when he was three. Mom called it. Her name is Laura End. I call it the end hypothesis, not necessarily the opposite of the beginning, but the end hypothesis.
Have revealed how babies breastfeed. It was previously thought that babies use a compression motion of the nipple.
This
to
is what Marissa talked about.
But the new Paris images also show that babies extract milk by lowering their tongue to create a vacuum. The ability to produce a strong vacuum may explain why some babies are stronger suckers than others.
So in addition to what Marissa said, she was totally correct. But there's also a vacuum that's formed. and it really helps expand all the baby's suture. I'm sorry, this is not, yeah. So this is from museum specimens that Mariana Evans and I are studying at the Penn Museum. These are sutures, they're fontanelles. They're like the soft spots on a baby's head. The way the brain grows the cranium, the cranial vault, it gets bigger, and those soft spots eventually get closer and closer, and eventually that cartilage turns into bone. But they still remain patent, okay? They're called cranial sutures, and cranial osteopathy is something that can manipulate those. Well, you have them all over your face and your jaws. I call it the palatal facial fontanelle complex or sutural complex. And the tongue and nipple are responsible for building a home. The tongue is responsible for building a home for itself to live in for the rest of its life. And it occurs from in utero when they start chewing amniotic fluid and pushing the tongue forward on the breast when they're breastfeeding. And this is what really develops the whole face, the whole palate, and the airway that gets ignored, okay? And these sutures, again, they're not just on the skull. They're not just in the palate. They're in the orbit. Look at the moving, growing eyeball develops the orbital cavity, just like the brain develops the cranial cavity. And that the tongue chewing and the nipple during breastfeeding will develop the palatal facial sutural complex. It widens at the mid-palatal suture and pushes forward on these facial sutures. This is what happened throughout human history. This is what I study mostly at the Penn Museum, is I'm studying fetal skulls of babies, you know, fetuses that didn't make it, you know, 100,000 years ago. Thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, before the Industrial Revolution. And look at this. This is, you know, before the fontanelles are closed. This is a young child, and these are adults here. And Mariana is, we're establishing norms for all of these to inform the norms that orthodontists and pediatric dentists and general dentists learn about in their training. We need to inform them with anthropological norms. We've renamed the craniofacial complex to the craniofacial respiratory complex. And what Dr. Townsend is going to talk about is how these nutrients in milk, not just vitamins and minerals, but oligosaccharides can help. There's so many things we don't know. There's four main purposes of oligosaccharides that Dr. Townsend will talk about, but there's probably more that help develop this whole palatal craniofacial respiratory complex. So this is really the end what happens. If you can develop this really early, and we say start to fix before the age of six, and that's something that Candy Sparks came up with, and we really want to get to these kids before they start losing baby teeth, and we want to grow and help this airway. When you grow the face, you grow the airway, and this is what we want to do for all children. So that's really all I have, and I'd like to turn this over now to Pat and let her delegate what happens next.
Okay, Dr. We're ready. Do you need to have your slide sharing enabled? Yes. You need to unmute yourself?
Yes. Yep, I think I need to have my...
you want me to
Here, Howie, enabled. Can you enable the slide sharing?
Yeah, let me just find his slide.
Nope, and it just happened, actually.
Yeah. Okay, there you go.
Cool. Okay. So... All right, am I ready to go?
Go ahead, Steve.
All right, go away. There you go. All right.
So, you know, I'm happy to speak to everyone this evening for about 4 or 5 minutes about my group's research interest in human milk science. Interestingly, this all started from a sociological perspective, which we heard a little bit about earlier. But my wife and I were both trainees in New York City. I'm an organic chemist. My wife works in the area of domestic violence prevention against women and children. And so she was training at Columbia. We're walking through Harlem, and she notices on the wall next to the Apollo Theater a massive poster for Similac. And so, you know, for me as a dude, this wasn't anything uncommon. But as a soon-to-be mom, she knew that this was actually out of the ordinary, because in most countries in the world, you actually can't advertise infant formula aggressively. And so she did her homework and went back and pulled a map of New York City. And it turns out that New York City probably has either the second or third best support for breastfeeding across the country. Yet those resources, free lactation consultants, lactation rooms, any resource you can imagine, they're highly concentrated in areas where people make more than $1 million. So these are areas that are highlighted in dark color squares. These are areas around Central Park, the Financial District, and in Midtown. If, however, you go to areas where poor people live, such as Chinatown, Harlem, the Bronx, Queens, and Brooklyn, you see light color squares, and these are places where New York City does not invest in free breastfeeding resources. So as somebody who is internally a humanist, you know, I'm a PhD chemist. No one's going to pay for me to solve this problem of why we treat each other like this. But people will pay for me to tease apart human milk to figure out exactly what is special about milk and what makes it different from cow's milk, which is the basis of infant formula. So we can go on an exercise and think about what's actually in different sources of milk. It turns out that regardless of what animal you are, lactose is likely the most common molecule present in your milk. For most animals, the second most common molecule is just fat. And then if we start to think about protein, this is where things get really special and really different. So very big animals like cows, like lions and tigers, they typically need to be pretty big. That's part of their defense mechanisms, part of their evolution. And so they have a lot of protein in their milk. This is not the case for primates. And so for us, it's more important that our brains develop faster than our bodies. And so in this case, we have a decreased amount of protein, almost no protein in human milk. And instead we have these complex sugars that are not lactose, they're different. And they're known as the human milk oligosaccharides. And so the question becomes, how special are they? Well, if we start to go through a variety of different animals' milks, it turns out that humans have very special milk. So we have about 8 to 20 grams per liter of complex carbohydrates, or these human milk oligosaccharides. And women produce about 200 unique structures. No other animal, including most of our primate brethren, can match our diversity and the amount of sugars that we put in milk. Now, if you want some patterns, unfortunately, we don't really have any. It turns out you can pull a little bit of data apart. Animals that produce one baby at a time typically have a lot of sugars in their milk. Primates, of course, have a lot of sugars. And then animals like kangaroos that breastfeed or do an equivalent of breastfeeding for a very short period of time. And of course, this is a cute picture of one of the students milking a mouse, because we apparently do that. All right, so a little bit more about these sugars as we hit the home stretch. It turns out, again, there's 200 unique sugars that are possible in human milk. They range from little tiny molecules to ones that are very big, like cellulose that we see in plants. It turns out that based on your blood type, different women produce different sugars. And so ultimately, it boils down to the fact that some women produce very few sugars, usually about 25 different sugars in their milk. Some produce as many as 125, and they change over the course of lactation. So the sugars that you make on day one are different than the ones that you make at the end of 10 months. It turns out these sugars actually change about every 18 to 24 hours. There's some feedback mechanism between baby and mom, which triggers mom to change the composition of her milk. Even that is not really well understood in 2022. Now, if I were to ask everyone who's joining us tonight, what's the purpose of sugar? Most people would scream out metabolism. We use that for energy. It turns out this is a wonder of human evolution. Mom spends about 500 calories per day making these sugars, and babies will get 0 calories from them. We can't metabolize them. So if they're not for us, who are they for? Well, it turns out they're generally for microorganisms. Back in the 1980s, we know that these compounds were found to be basically glorified fiber. Mom uses these compounds to direct the growth of specific bacteria in the baby's body. So if she wants bifidobacteria to dominate the microbiome of the baby's gut, mom will make very small compounds. If she wants Bacteroides to dominate the gut, she will make very long compounds. It's very fine-tuned which sugars mom makes to guide the evolution of specific bacteria. Now, in the 90s, it was figured out that these compounds are called anti-adhesive antimicrobial agents. For those who don't know, if you think about how infection works in the gut, if a bacteria or a virus wants to infect you, it typically needs to identify a carbohydrate that's on your epithelium. Well, because mom is generally brilliant, what she does is put these human milk oligosaccharides in her milk. They look exactly similar to the ones that are on your epithelium. And so instead of attaching to you, these microorganisms that are pathogens will attach to these milk sugars and get filtered out of the body. So this is another mechanism that mom uses to keep her baby safe. Our group came onto the scene, and we were ultimately granted tenure for figuring out that these compounds have antibiotic properties, so they can kill bad bacteria, even though they don't kill good bacteria. And interestingly, they are anti-biofilm compounds. Think about the crap that crusts your teeth when you wake up in the morning. It turns out that these sugars can prevent biofilms from forming on the teeth and from other surfaces. And so as we sort of hit the home stretch here and close it down, what our group is trying to do is really figure out what the molecules in human milk do, and then see if we can use that to solve problems in adult health and wellness. We just recently published a really cool paper where we're showing that you can take these human milk sugars from breast milk and use them to mitigate the damage that's caused by chemotherapy. We're trying to move this now into a patient population. So that's all I have for you today, and I will stop talking.
Absolutely fantastic. Thanks everybody for your input. We can open up our cameras and we're gonna go to the Q&A section, which is pretty profound. So let's see, the questions that came in was for Marissa, and by clicking on frenectomy, they wanted clarification to say, do you mean a certain age of the baby, timing on feeding, or timing mom are ready?
Yes, so all of the above. timing in terms of all of those factors. So we want mom to be ready. We do take baby's age into consideration as well. And then, so what I do with my patients is I obviously assess breastfeeding. Now, let's say baby is almost exclusively bottle fed. When we put baby to breast, baby transfers zero. And baby has, baby's kind of squint up, pushing away, isn't very happy about being brought to breast. I would not say that family is ready for frenectomy. That's the kind of case with that dyad where if we did a frenectomy, we might see even more bouts of breast refusal and just more bottle feeding for comfort because there is pain after surgery. I want to see breastfeeding improving before frenectomy or at least be stable before frenectomy. I also want to see baby's weight gain be stable before frenectomy. And that's something that not everybody agrees upon, but a lot of us in the lactation field do find they do so much better post-op if their weight gain is at least getting a little bit better, because a lot of these babies will start off, you know, 80 percentile at birth and then drop to like third percentile. And then sometimes that's when the parents run in for frenectomy to save the weight gain situation, the weight issue. And then things just get worse sometimes. And now we're in the first percentile. Now we're talking about a feeding tube. And I get a lot of those cases. I tend to attract more complex cases. That's what I generally see. But yeah, timing matters on the switch side. You know, on the other end, I get a lot of families with a second baby where they want to get the frenectomy immediately. So either in the hospital or, you know, driving home from the hospital, they'll stop at the pediatric dentist office day two, day three. That can also not go so well. We think about babies, they come out very flexed. There's that physiological flexion from being, you know, tightly packed in mom's uterus. And so sometimes I see more reattachment with those little babies who were released day two. Sometimes mom had a traumatic birth. Maybe she had a lot of tearing. If it was, you know, a rough delivery vaginally, maybe she had a C-section and she's really struggling to move around her house. Maybe she has an infection, you know, at the incision of her C-section. She's struggling with that, you know, that's the reality, unfortunately. And so then, or maybe she's getting rehospitalized for something blood pressure related. And now no one is doing wound care because, you know, the one person who kind of learned how to do it is not around. So we want to make sure mom's stable, baby's stable. We want to make sure we do think that the baby's going to benefit from frenectomy and that the family's goals are likely to be reached, or at least we're going to move closer to their goals.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's wonderful. One of the things that we talked about is access to human breast milk by the general public. It's very expensive. I know from my, we serve an underserved population. So the Mother's Milk Bank here, the families have access, even on Medicaid out here, to Mother's Milk through the Mother's Milk Bank, as long as the baby's still in hospital. So are there resources for moms who, as far as you know, you're in Texas. I mean, I'm in California, Howie's in New York, that they can ask a human breast if mom can't or won't continue to nurse for whatever reason. And there's no judgment whatsoever.
Yeah, we're very lucky in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas in that our milk banks receive more milk than the NICUs need. So typically it is possible to get milk from the milk banks around here. It's it's $22 for 7 ounces. So it's expensive and they limit how much can go to each family. So that's one option that works for a lot of babies. It will work if baby has a food allergy though, because the milk bank doesn't distribute hypoallergenic milk where the mother wasn't taking in any cow's milk products. That's one of the most common, that is the most common infant food allergy. So that's one issue with the milk bank. Then there's also informal milk sharing is on the rise, and that can be done. There are different Facebook groups in each state where moms can connect with other moms who are donating milk.
That's great.
So one of the things we've heard from this, everybody had a very short time to present, and hopefully we'll do other webinars will be longer time, is that there is really a difference between the milk from breastfeeding and formula. And it's not, if you can't do it, you just do formula. And especially since we have these pandemics with all these viruses coming around, who knows what protection breastfeeding actually gives these kids and helps their immune system develop better. Marissa, you had talked about the issues with mothers feeling shamed because they're not breastfeeding or the pressure from peer pressure. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we spoke about that a few days ago and I didn't mention it, so I'm so happy you brought it up. I hear it a lot from my patients. All they wanted was to breastfeed. They dreamed about breastfeeding when they were pregnant. And now for whatever reason, it's not coming together. Maybe they didn't realize that the breast reduction surgery they had 10 years ago messed with their breast anatomy to the point where they, despite our best efforts, they're not making enough milk. And it can be really devastating. There are other situations too, hormonal imbalance, insufficient glandular tissue. And there's lots and lots of situations or truly just poor stimulation early on that we struggle to catch up on. Maybe mom went back to work really, really early and is struggling with pumping at work. So if a mom isn't making enough milk, absolutely. This for a mom who dreamed about breastfeeding, especially if she identifies as being more holistic, more in the know. I get dentists, I have midwives as patients, you know, people who are more in the know and now they can't do it. It's absolutely devastating. And I had a mom tell me recently, she was just bawling in the formula aisle. They had the formula she needed, but she was just so embarrassed to be in the formula aisle and never thought that was going to happen to her, you know? So it can be extremely upsetting. And sometimes, you know, we want to talk about the benefits and how amazing it is. And I do talk about the benefits, but in certain situations, it can make moms feel even worse knowing that they can't give that to the baby, to their baby, and they had planned on it.
One thing I would say about that, I see a lot of mothers coming in who, again, have been to many, many different people, and they're on $90 a day formula now. The mother's been on an elimination diet. And they get to me through their new IBCLC or chiropractor. We do the surgery, release the tongue, and the reflux disappears almost overnight because it's all air-induced. They're swallowing air and causing them to throw up. And it's not the mother's milk they're allergic to. And we get them back on the breast milk with, you know, working with the IBCLC. So, you know, a lot of times when parents are told that they're in an elimination diet and they have an allergic reaction to mother's milk, you really need the tongue has got to be part of the differential diagnosis. Yeah. Because sometimes it's an anatomic defect that is causing the problem, not the mother's milk, and get them off these formulas. So, you know, again, we talk about a group working together. I think that we really need to look at these, what I call restricted tethered oral tissues. And, you know, they can go to my website and download a form and it'll show them all of the different kind of symptoms they have, whether they're a newborn or a 10-year-old who's got ADD and ADHD. And, you know, we can get to all this with frenectomies, but there's a lot more to doing a frenectomy than just getting the mother on the breast, or the baby on the mother's breast. But we really can save a lot of mothers' anxiety and stress by timing these frenectomies at the right time.
You know, and the ultimate goal is that every mother gets the right combination of treatments that they need. You know, Larry tends to get all the people and he does his frenectomies and he sees the results, but other people need other things even before that. Steve, I wanted to say that when I was in undergraduate school, organic chemistry was the course that was described as, if you couldn't pass it, you shouldn't go to medical or dental school. So that was sort of the bar. you are by far the most interesting and entertaining and informative chemist I ever remember meeting. And you have such, you're not only doing research, but you do it with such passion. I don't know whether you're looking at the chat box. People love you. So we welcome you to our community. It's great. Nobody really appreciates the difference in what's in breast milk. So I think this is great. We want to hear more about that. Pat, any other questions that you want to bring up?
No, I think we're good for right now. This has been a great wet your whistle conference night. Everybody, we'd like to have you all back. Larry's going to be back at the end of the year.
What's your whistle with breast milk? And Kevin, thank you so much for introducing us to Steve.
Right. So we've got Larry coming back just in shortly towards the end of the year. And Dr. Boyd is on INDAR and the AAPMD webinars pretty routinely. And we'll have a longer webinar for both Steve and for Marissa coming up as we move into 2023. So anybody who had a question that wasn't answered our panel tonight, please don't hesitate to add in them to the chat box. We will go ahead and tabulate those and get them out to the individual person. And from a final standpoint, I think one of the small points that is in my world to kind of push forward here is that any and everything that we all do, I think we all must be mindful of what is both appropriate for the people that serve, and that we have to understand that these are actual people that are attached to whatever issue is going on with their lives, be it for themselves, the moms, the babies, the family, the external family, and their community of their peers. And our sensitivity to that is ultimately what's going to help get them across the board. Yeah. So thank you guys for doing this.
And Pat, we should say the reason we formed the social justice section of the APMD is because if these things are so important to the life, health, and potential of every child, access has to be made available to everybody, not just for, and I think what's your wife's name, Steve?
Her name's Latoya Townsend.
Yeah.
Great
great map of what happens in the city, that the people who need it least have the most access to care.
Access to it.
And we feel the same way in our airway issues, that if breathing well and good arch development and is so important to what happens later in life, everybody has to be able to have access to the care. We have to make it available. And one of the first things is people don't even have the information. They don't even know that this is what they're missing. I think the progression is not to figure out how to fund it, but get everybody the information, because we get enough people the information, we can build an army to make that happen. So I think that's what we want. And to everybody who's on our webinar tonight, when we do our next webinar of this series, make sure you invite your friends, your patients, your family, everybody you know, because this is health is not just the under the ownership of practitioners. Everybody's responsible, because the healthier we are as a society, the better we function as a society.
Stephen, one thing I'm going to say for you, I've been doing this for almost 48 years. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I'm seeing so many more minority mothers coming in. The whole culture is changing there. On a week where I might have seen one person of color in a month, now I'm seeing 2 or 3 families come in every week. Mm-hmm. And I think that the culture of the communities are changing for the better. And I really have been impressed. And I always talk to these mothers and say, go back to your community, you're the emissary. And they send other women to me. So it may be bad in Harlem because they put on the signs, but I got to tell you, it's improving significantly. And I see patients from Manhattan, New York City, Buffalo, and there are a lot of minorities. And I take the Medicaid for that because that's what I think they need, and they will have it. So the access is improving and understanding is improving. So maybe that'll make you feel better tonight. I definitely think that there are more minority people searching out and getting the proper care, at least in my practice.
This is wonderful. So it was just great. Just want a final note for some of the folks who are asking if they watch the video again, which is there's so much information. It does require a second look. The AAPMD website will post this up in the next day or so. And anybody who is watching, you can send it along and have free access and watch it again.
And one more slide to put up. So let me see if I can find it. Here we go. This is a great resource page that Marissa put up. And I think we got it all. Then anybody wants, they can take a picture of that. Or I'll tell you what, I'll have Patty send this resource list to everybody who's on this webinar. And I'll also send Larry Cutlow's website. He has a wealth, he just redid his website, a wealth of information on that. And I think that aside from being practitioners, whatever we do, however we make a living, we are absolutely compelled to be the educators in our community, because if we have the knowledge, sharing the knowledge is good. Get your patients to watch the webinar. It's a wonderful resource. I mean, this was fantastic. I loved it. I what a great group we have here. And you know, we're all about collaboration, and this is like a great collaborative meeting. So that's my last word, Pat.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you all again for coming. Really nice to have met you, Steve. Good to see you again, Larry. See you again shortly. The months will fly by. And Kev, as usual. So thank you, Marissa. Look forward to our webinar from you as we move forward into the new year. And thank you all for attending. So we'll see you soon. Take care.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Good night.